Yeah, there's Mr. Flair too. Today on ANC Report, I have Robert Enlakesh coming in just a few moments. We're going to be talking about the Zionist psychopaths and their treatment of Gaza as well as the West Bank. It's unbelievable what's been going on. And, it's something else that there have been other atrocities in Syria, in Yemen, what have it, you name it. But at least they're on the news. When it comes to Gaza, when it comes to Palestine, there doesn't seem to be a line that the Israelis can cross that will even get reported in the media. So I have Robert on today. We're going to walk through just some of the recent things that Israel's been doing. How you doing, sir?
What's up, man? How are you?
Nice flag you got there in the background. You ready to talk about Gaza? I heard they've been bombing them. I mean, you wouldn't know from watching the mass media that the bombing of Gaza even occurred.
All you would know is there were Israeli civilians coming under the evil Hamas terror rocket fire, and that they responded, even by the BBC, which put out an initial report. Which told the truth about what happened in the latest, I guess you could call it, flare up between the Gaza Strip, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and all of the other resistance organizations and Israel. The BBC put out a report and they told the truth in the headline. They said Israeli airstrike, I'm paraphrasing it now, killed a pregnant woman and her child. Then later, after pressure from the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs and a whole bunch of others, they decided to change the headline to "After Hamas Rocket Attack, a Woman and Her Child Were Killed." Like, so the capitulation by the media there, you can see. Also, the media completely ignores the reality of what's actually happening leading up to this recent flare-up. There was supposed to be a truce fire. Talk going on, talks going on, which were managed by Egypt. And it was supposed to be that Hamas were looking to sign some sort of agreement with Israel so that there would not be any more of this tit for tat happening. That went on for about a week. And on the last day of this, Israel decided that it would strike in the Gaza Strip, killing Hamas members. And then after this, okay, all of this is ignored, of course, by the mainstream media. After this, the day after, when all the talks are done, after the unprovoked strike killed Hamas members in the north of the Gaza Strip, the Hamas organization, the movement, released an official statement following these talks, saying that due to what has happened in the context of what's just happened with Israel striking them, launching an unprovoked strike, they're not willing to abandon armed resistance. And basically, in the statement, they were basically asserting themselves and saying that they were going to retaliate for the Israeli strikes. And Israel also interpreted Hamas's statement this way as well. And you can tell because of the press releases that day from the Israeli media and by the Israeli military. And the closure of several routes and roads, which in particular Route 25, which leads to the Gaza Strip from the Israeli territory. And this all, of course, was missed by the mainstream media. And when Hamas did start firing its fireworks and the sirens started going off, we heard that Israel was under attack and it was unprovoked. There wasn't any context. And the mainstream media, this is a blatant example. I mean, the BBC report their capitulation, that's an example of. And they will claim, as they have responded to people who filed this allegation against them, that they changed it due to the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. They'll claim that it wasn't for that reason, but we know it's for that reason. But looking at this entire situation, just the latest little flare-up, we can tell that the mainstream media ignores Israeli press and it ignores on the ground Palestinian reports, and it ignores statements made and issued by organizations like Hamas.
Well, you're correct, and that's what the BBC and European media did. When you're talking about mainstream media, they'll start the story in the middle and they'll rationalize it and they'll put it in Israel's favor. The American mass media doesn't even do that much. They just don't even talk about it. Israel can kill a pregnant woman and her infant daughter, blow up houses, shoot kids in the face, do whatever it wants. And they don't even blame it on Hamas. They just don't even say a thing. Kids get killed in Yemen. It'll be on, like, page 9, you know. Something happens in Syria, somebody will report it, at least in, like, the newspapers. But the mass media, you know what they were talking about when Gaza was getting bombed? LeBron James, a basketball player or something. And, like, how the president said something they thought was mean. That's what they were talking about, a basketball player, while Gaza was having the shit blown out of it.
Yeah, and with American weapons as well, American-supplied weapons.
Well, that's across the board, really. It's American-supplied weapons, and that for Saudis killing people in Yemen for... Well, we all saw in Daraa, right, when the Syrian army retook that southwest corner near the Golan Heights, caches of weapons, tow missiles from the United States. You know, ISIS wasn't building these things. And, you know, that was a lot of the Obama-era aid and the CIA giving al-Qaeda guns. And it's the same thing. Trump just signed the NDAA for this year, which gave the Zionist racial colonists, racist bastards, $5.5 billion. $5.5 billion. While he's saying, put America first, let's build up American bridges and roads and infrastructure, and $5.5 billion going to the Hebes, while Detroit and American cities, Baltimore, etc., are just falling apart. It looks like a bomb hit these cities. Something worse than a bomb hit those cities. Democrats hit those cities. But we're not going to fix any of that up because we got to go send the shekels to Israel.
It's absolutely disgraceful. I mean, again, back to the reporting, though. If you don't even have reporting on this, then how will anything change? And the people don't even know. They just don't know. And then when they're absolutely forced to report on it, then we see them... Oh, Hamas are a terrorist organization. They fire the rockets and blah, 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 and terror tunnels and human shields, which there's never been any sort of report from any sort of organization anywhere. The only one that have ever launched make up that there were human shields were politicians. That's it. There's never been any evidence provided for human shields being used by Hamas or any organization in the Gaza Strip whilst they've been fighting against Israel. It's never been the case. But you get all of these same propaganda lines and they're spewed out in almost the same order by these people. Every single one of these propaganda heads, all the politicians, they're given the list, and we know from the documents released, they're read these lines to them. They're made to read these documents. This is how you respond to this. This is how you respond to that. And nobody knows anything about it. I mean, since 1967, it's been a predominant theme in media throughout the world is Israel, Palestine. Whenever big things happen, it does reach the media in some form or another. How is it in the media every single year in some form or another, and still nobody knows anything about it? They don't know even a scintilla of what is happening there. How can this be a predominant story in the media and nobody knows anything about it? It always pops up. It's always here and there. You're always hearing about, Israel, Palestine, here and there. But nobody knows anything. How is that? How can that be if it's not for the corruption of the media?
Speedy Anarchy just sent a donation of 20 NOK shekels to Robert. Thank you very much. And they want to say, you are on the right side of history, my friend. But thank you very much for that. The first shekel of the night, 20 NOK. Yes, we are on the right side of history. And just, you know, fine, okay. I don't see... Why not? I mean, someone asked above, they didn't send any shekels. We're like, why should we give a shit about kids in Yemen or Gaza? Their name was Dix Lexus, because we're not all dicks. That's why. It's the moral thing, but if you want some sort of self-interested type of argument, it affects you. You know, it affects you in the gas pump. It affects your life. Why not? Why care about Yemen? Do you know how much that has cost? Do you know how much wars in the Middle East have cost American taxpayers? $6 trillion. I just said they gave $5.5 billion to Israel this year. That's $5.5 billion shekels from your country going over to murder kids in Yemen and Gaza. That's why you should care. If you're a cold-hearted piece of shit that doesn't, it doesn't bother you that kids get mutilated and their heads blown off and pregnant women and their children get killed, if that's not going to move you from a humanitarian standpoint because you wouldn't want that to happen to your children or whatever, how about because you're paying for it in the trillions, trillions with a T, and that affects kids in the United States too. We've got our own starving in the Appalachians. We got our own homeless problem. We got our own housing problem. We have our own healthcare problem. We got lots of problems, and a lot of them could be fixed with that $6 trillion. But the U.S. has blown it, killing kids in Iraq, killing kids in Syria, Libya, Yemen, all over the Middle East for Israeli interests. It's not in American interests. The oil import-export didn't change after Iraq. It did for Israel. They got 77% of their oil imports from the Kurdish region of Iraq. Oded Yanan is the script for Syria. They wanted a civil war like they had had in Lebanon. They purposely fostered sectarian violence. Our own DIA documents are admitting that they are fostering a Salafist principality, including Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is now in Syria, a.k.a. ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. That is our own creation on Israel's behalf. So it's not just about Palestinians. This is a great, much bigger issue. But it's the same thing. The more they annex territory, the more they blow up little kids, the more they have a blockade. The blockade decreases trade across the Middle East too. The more they control that Suez traffic and Red Sea traffic of import, export of gas, oil, etc., the more expensive your life is. So if you're the kind of piece of shit that doesn't care about little kids getting blown up, about families being destroyed, you have no heart, no empathy, no compassion because you're an animal, then how about because it's too damn expensive? How about that for a reason? Sorry, but somebody asked a stupid question, you're going to get put in the woodshed and have an equivalent answer.
Well, I swear, and also, this, the thing off with these sort of people that say this sort of thing is, and I don't think, like, I think you just hit the nail on the head right there with all that, but is that they live in this false sort of, like this dream world where they do actually carry it around. Oh, yeah, I do live in an amazing country that does amazing things. And we're so good here. We're so civil here. You know, those barbaric people over there and blah, 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 they're not my children and not related to me. They're just in another place in the world. And everything is just in my little bubble and all of that. The thing that pisses me off is, why don't you admit that your government's fucked up? The way you think is fucked up. You're primitive. And basically, you're a psychopath and you don't have any understanding of the world around you. And you're basically the product of a propaganda system. Like, why not admit that? And also, like you said, it does actually hurt you in the pockets. And if you're living in Europe, well, look what's happened to Europe because of this. And it's not the fault of people who are pouring into Europe. It's not their fault. It's your fucking fault for enabling it all to happen and not even holding them. And this is the thing that annoys me is when you get all these people, like, look at, they destroyed Libya. Gaddafi was holding back all of these people from going into Europe. Gaddafi did that. They destroyed Syria. They've destroyed the entirety of the Middle East. They're fucking with Africa still. And you're just okay with it? Well, then it starts hitting you in the pockets. Then a lot of these people start coming to your countries and it's overwhelming on your social services and all sorts of different things for your country. Then you don't get angry at your government for causing that. You don't get angry at the policies. You don't get angry at anything that's been done to cause this situation. Then you put the blame on the people who have sought a better life in a country.
Well, they'll blame the victims. They'll blame the victims. And yeah, this left side of the bell curve, double-digit IQ plebs, they can't see the bigger picture. They don't see that. They just are like, well, why should I care about someone that lives far away? I mean, I swear to you, that is the level, and it's why politicians are able to get away with this. And they don't see the consequences down the road. Not only to just, it's already a consequence to someone else, but it boomerangs right back to you. Like, Gaddafi is a good example. They killed Gaddafi, they opened the plug, and floods of refugees pour into Europe. A portion of them are going to be rapists and murderers and mugs and stuff. Some of them are just Islamic State, just, you know, blending in. There was just a Yazidi sex slave that escaped Iraq, went to Germany, and ran into one of her captors and had to flee again because Germany had let this serial rapist into their country. But this is all caused by smacking the hornet's nest. You know, if you didn't destabilize people and ruin their infrastructure, not only through warfare, but through predatory lending with the IMF, and that IMF, FF, it should echo, I guess. If they didn't have that decimating these nations economically, there wouldn't be so many people seeking, some of them, you know, to work in a better, you know, life, and some of them also to live off the Dola's welfare queens, kind of like the royal family in the UK. But all that happens, and there are a couple questions I want to get to from Streamlabs where I keep ranting. We'll go in order. Lav, I'm not even trying to pronounce your last name, but Radoslavljevic or something. Sorry, man, I don't speak Kukanese. What? Sweden, sorry. He donates 50 crowns. What do you anticipate will be the final result of this conflict? That is a very good question. And the second question is, Erdogan behind the funding of terrorist groups? To Tanvir, the Erdogan question, the short answer, yes. But let's tackle Lav's question. What do you think, or what do you anticipate will be the final result of this conflict of Israel and Palestine? That is a large question to answer. Do you want to share your thoughts on that first, or you want me to tackle that? Either way.
I can share my thoughts on that. I mean, to say and profess that I know exactly what's going to happen, how it's going to go down, what's going to occur is really difficult. I'm presuming he means Israel-Palestine, right, by this conflict, like in general conflict. Mm-hmm. Right now it's sort of a standstill because Israel, they want to get rid of these people in Gaza, for one. They want to get rid of the people in the West Bank because it poses a huge demographic threat to them. The only way I can see physically Israel, let's say, losing this and the Palestinians gaining their full rights, the day where we might see a Palestinian leader of the strip of land that is Palestine, where Israel has imposed itself upon them. The only situation where I can see it happening now from this point of view right now is not militarily, because the Palestinians don't have the capability of militarily defeating them as like a military force or army. They have the capability of pushing back settlements, fighting the soldiers, scaring them into submission and stopping them, like enrolling them back in a sense, and inflicting small defeats upon them and their soldiers. They can do that in little increments. But militarily, they're not going to defeat them. And the countries that would be able to inflict sort of military defeats on them would be invaded by the United States. Well, at least, you know, like I'd say just blown to bits by the United States if they tried. So the demographic is really the only choice the Palestinians have. And to keep resisting until... basically, there's more Palestinians living in that Palestine. Let's look at it in its entirety, or you want to call it Israel, or whatever you want to call it, in that land right now. There's more Arabs, there's more than Jewish people living there. And a lot of those Jews as well, around half of the Jews of the Jewish population of the state of Israel, are not white Jews. They're Middle Eastern Jews with Middle Eastern heritage, Middle Eastern backgrounds. And they used to speak Arabic, if not, a lot of them still do speak Arabic. So eventually, if it carries on the way it does, and there's some sort of struggle, like armed struggle, civil rights struggles, all different types of struggles from the Palestinian people, eventually they, without the return of the Palestinian refugees, will be the majority in the land if it maintains its it maintains itself as a so-called democracy where people can vote. Then Arabs would just Arab Palestinians would vote in an Arab Palestinian government, but they're not going to let that happen. So from now they will seek, I'm assuming, to try and expel as many people or push them away. They've got plans to try and push the people of Gaza into the Sinai. Some of them want to hand Gaza over to Egypt and Jordan over the West Bank over to Jordan. That's what they want to do. They've got various different plans that they want to implement in order to get over it. But when it comes down to it, they can't sustain themselves as an overwhelmingly Jewish state in the long run. Even if those Arab, the Arab population now of Israel, so the Palestinians who are living inside of what they call Israel now. They're roughly, I think, around 20%. And that demographic just keeps growing and growing. Eventually, they're going to have so many Palestinians living amongst them, even in that piece of land where they are now the majority, that it's not going to be a Jewish state anymore. So what are they going to do? Because to them, the
they're
end
trying
of
to make
Israel,
it unlivable and then not have right of return and push the Palestinians out. But it's not working. And I see things, it could go that way. I see things a little differently. Just judging on the way these people think and the hubris they've had in history, they have like cyclical events where they bite off more than they can chew. And I think it's just a matter of time before they do that again. They kind of did that in 2006. They thought, okay, we have a one-on-one with Hezbollah. The Lebanese military is not going to interfere. The Syrian military has been forced out of Lebanon under the pretext of the assassination of Rafik Hariri. And so we got them. We'll push them across the Latini River, and we'll annex all the territory in between. And what happened was these cowards that make up the Israeli military and IDF just, I mean, they run. As soon as bullets are, they flee. They have superior guns, numbers, everything, and they lost. They got spanked. And when you look at what's happened in Syria, Syria's won. They're right up to the borders of Golan Heights. They even chipped away the southern tip, is now part of Syria again, regaining territory just like Assad's father did. The empire tried its proxy war in Syria, the same as Libya, and it didn't work. And one of the main reasons was air defense. And I'll tell you why this is important. And this is in the Palestine updates and Syria updates, or the interview I did with the Saker. The weakness that the West has right now, it's not guns, it's not population, it's not propaganda. They run Hollywood, they have banks, they got money, they have that. It's cowardice. They cannot get skin in the game. And that's thanks to the moral people that comprise the West, not their governments. They don't want, after the Iraq War and the disaster and all the lies with that, they don't want another one. This is the new Vietnam syndrome. They will not put boots on the ground, because if 1,000 Americans die or something, unless America gets attacked or something, they're not motivated to do a war in another country for a third party. And that's why they couldn't put boots on the ground in Syria. All of the politicians wanted it, but they couldn't get it. The public was calling 1,000 to 1 not to do that. So they used a proxy force, and the proxy force got its ass kicked by Syria, Hezbollah, and Russia with Iranian financial backing. And so the empire died in Syria. That war's over. Idlib's going to get smashed. They're all infighting. We just did a Syria update with Andrew Illingworth. You can go see that on Vimeo On Demand. I'll provide the links. That the writing's on the wall. That's done. So Israel's looking around. Its first plan was to annex territory from its neighbors, right? It got defeated in Lebanon first. It's been defeated in Syria. It's not going to get into Egypt, you know. And so they're picking on what's left. Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and they're trying to annex more territory from Palestinians. But here's the thing. The S-400 and S-300 air defense is going all around that area. And if you can protect yourself from European and American cruise missiles, that's all you have to do. Because they will not go in on the ground unless they blow the hell out of you from the air first so they can minimize casualties. Yeah, America could still win if it wanted to lose 6,000-7,000 soldiers, and it doesn't. And Israel can't even stomach 100 soldiers. 105, 107 Hebes died fighting the Lebanese, and they quit. The Oy Vein reached fever pitch, and so this is their weakness. They can't have boots on the ground. And as Robert alluded to earlier, if they're going to really go into Gaza and take out Hamas, they're going to die. Some Israelis will die. You can't just have an air campaign indefinitely. That's something to shut up the public temporarily, because the majority of Israel's public are ardent racist, fanatic, religious, you know, morons that, like, God gave us that land. But, you know, when it comes time to, like, okay, get in there and take it, put your boots on and go, they don't want to go. In fact, I have a nice clip here showing you the bravery of the IDF going on a bus with sniper rifles to go shoot children throwing pebbles. Let's take a look at this. It should start in a couple seconds. It's just like, this pretty much sums up the Israeli army. There you go, we have weapons, they only have stone. I think if you're there, you can smell pee.
But see, this is exactly why, if you can still hear me,
Okay, so that's the invincible IDF there, afraid of kids throwing pebbles, and it wasn't just one guy. Several of them are scared. Oh, it's Friday. They're gonna be acting up. The uppity Arabs. Oh, these children. They can turn a stone into a bomb. I don't want to die. All right, that's, you know, Israel and the Hebes are not known for being these great warriors or anything. There's a lot of propaganda and stuff. When it comes down to it, these guys shit their diapers. They actually wear diapers in the IDF. They piss on themselves. They cry like little bitches, you know. They're scared of their own shadow. Oh, 1999 from Lurch 685. Israeli bravery. Ha 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 ha. These clips are worth the donations alone. Dude, if you want to see some clips that have all been ovened from YouTube, go to the Palestinian updates on Vimeo On Demand, because my favorite one is these sirens are going off. First of all, there's these Israeli punks, and they're in there with their tank tops and stuff, and they're like, you know, they're sitting there like this, like, oh yeah, I'm so big, and yeah, I'm just like David Duke posing and being like, we're so tough, and Hamas ain't nothing, and da-da. And then the bomb siren goes off, and they all scatter like, ah! And one runs like 2 feet smack into a steel pole and knocks himself out cold. But I couldn't put it on YouTube, but that's all in there. There's a lot of glorious videos. Basically, every update that Robert and I do, we'll throw in some, you know, ridiculous. There's another one where these IDF guys got hit by a van and they're all there crying and curled up on the ground. They're pathetic, man. They're not going to be defeating anybody. All they can do is sit safely at a distance with American weapons and fire missiles and rockets from F-15s and artillery into Gaza. It's not going to work. The writing's on the wall. The long-term result of this is the entire world community outside of the U.S. and Canada is already sick of it, right? They're just, the U.N. passes resolutions all the time, and it gets vetoed solely by the United States. So the moment that is out of the way, they will negotiate within a day. All the settlements are gone. It'll go back to the 1967 borders. And, you know, Israel will not be able to throw its weight around without American support. But that's why we've got to, you know, throw some shekels at this, boycott Israel. It needs to become a thing, and people need to not be afraid to express that opinion. To say, I mean, someone might call you anti-Semitic, or they might pay some actual anti-Semites to run around just like they do with the Confederate flag and act like, see, we're so racist, and this is what this represents. You know, don't let them, you know, half the little neo-Nazis online are not actually Nazis. They're Zionists pretending to that because that's what they need, right? They need to be everybody to be a Nazi, right? The Hollywood version of Nazis. They need just the epitome of evil. And they've just cried wolf too many times. And this is what happens over and over again in history when a particular culture that, you know, looks at itself as supreme above others ends up getting thrown out by all their neighbors. And they've got nowhere else to go, and they're not going to change their behavior. And they're a bunch of cowards. They're a bunch of front holes, you could say. And these front hole Israeli soldiers, if it ever comes to a real war, are going to lose. They're going to lose it all.
With them being cowards and jumping in on the point of them being cowards, this is the reason why we haven't seen a large-scale bombardment of the Gaza Strip as of yet, because Netanyahu has really been pushed into a corner by Hamas. Hamas keep responding. They keep firing these fireworks. The Israelis, the large majority of all of the so-called injuries have actually been panic attacks from the Israelis because the sirens go off, basically. And the Israeli governments are going back and forth with themselves. Should we go in and bomb Gaza or should we not? Because if we go in and we want to do anything to Hamas this time, just to inflict a blow upon them, we had to open up their tunnel system and we had to put boots on the ground. And if they open up the tunnel system, it means bombing, heavily bombing, bombarding. Densely populated areas, some of the most densely populated areas on Earth, and killing, I don't even want to imagine how many people, but tens of thousands of people in order to open up these tunnels. And then they would have to put boots on the ground. And if they did that, then if they were fully committed to pursuing this and going straight into the heart of Gaza with their military and rolling the tanks into the heart of Gaza, then they would have to lose hundreds of troops. And Hamas would kill them. I mean, every single time they go and they fight Hamas on the ground, Hamas kill them. Hamas kill them. They kill 20, 30 of them every single time. They kidnap their soldiers. And they can't take the kidnapped soldiers, and they can't take their dead soldiers because their dead soldiers are worse than dead civilians to them. And the population just think that, though they're this mighty ultimate force that can defeat anyone on Earth, the Jewish Air Force and the Jewish military and the Jewish Navy, and we're the strongest on Earth, we're the best, we're the most moral army on Earth, we're just the shit. And then if they go in on the ground, they're destroyed.
That video, whatever. I'm so sorry, but this, okay, the first question. I guess only Robert could hear me from Google Hangouts. Have they always been pussies? Like, yes, they've always been front holes. They've lost most of their wars. The wars they won were because Britain and France got in on their behalf. In 1956, over the Suez Crisis, it was the French and the British that attacked Britain, or that attacked Egypt with the Israelis. So they didn't win that war. Britain and France won that war. 1967, they preemptively struck the Egyptian Air Force while it was on the ground, while Egypt was already at war in Yemen fighting the Saudis. Yes, there was a war in Yemen against Saudi Arabia back then too. That's been a cyclical event. So while Egypt already has its handful and is sort of losing a war, they lost the most in 67 and 68. 68 is when they finally pull out of that war. Nasser's trying to defend Yemen against Saudi Arabia. And it does end up losing that conflict, and the whole map got rearranged because of that. While he's at weak like that, that's when Israel preemptively strikes, and they nearly brought in the Americans in that war too, by the USS Liberty incident. And of course, that was not an Egyptian boat, and yes, they knew it was an American ship. Johnson was in on it. Johnson's the first Jewish president of the United States, with the exception of possibly Lincoln. Some people differ on that, but he was sold. They killed Kennedy, and then in Yom Kippur they lost. They lost 30% of the Golan Heights, so they lost the war in 73. They lost the war in 2006 against Lebanon. So they've always been front holes. And in 73 they had support from their allies too, and they still lost. And that's when OPEC made the oil weapon, and that hurt the United States because of their support for Israel. That was a direct response to the U.S. support for Israel in Yom Kippur of 73. That's why they did the oil weapon. To break the oil weapon, they went to the largest oil reserves, which is Saudi Arabia. They bring the kingdom in under the U.S. economic wing. They created the Safari Club. They start piddling around in Africa, and then they create Al Qaeda. And so the Mossad and the Saudis and the U.S. create this giant proxy army to fight the Soviets because you can't go head to head anymore, so you need proxy armies. And they start the conflict in Afghanistan. They use them in the Balkans. They use them, of course, on 9/11, and then Libya, Syria, etc. That's been the model from 1979 to now. But that was all direct response to the War of Yom Kippur in 73, which they lost. The only one they really won was 67, because they preemptively hit Egypt while Egypt was already fighting someone else. So they've always been pussies. And then the second question that I'm answering for the second time was down here. Oh, thank you for telling me about the mic. I'm really sorry. Robert, jump in if you can't hear me. I don't know what happened there. I lost him on the call, that's why. Well, I will just re-invite him. There must have been some sort of glitch. Because he dropped off the call and my mic went down, but that happens. I'm calling him back right here. I can handle those questions, though. I'm sure he's going to have a lot more to say to that, but they've always been pussies. Another reason is they have mandatory service. And the reason a volunteer army is better than mandatory service is not everyone's a soldier. You can't just say, oh, we have X number of males, so we're just going to have X number of soldiers. I'm going to flip over to commercial right now so I can get all the tech stuff sorted out. Oh, thanks for the shekels there. And this is our sponsor. If you ever want some brain food, here's what you need to get, and I'll get Robert on the line while this is playing.
Introducing Cognitive Interrupter Alpha.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah?
No.
Scientifically formulated by men who look like doctors, this supplement has been proven in over 1.5 studies to heighten critical thinking while simultaneously preserving your myopic Abrahamic nationalist worldview while still keeping you on a short leash of ignorance and fear. Results may vary from person to person. May take 104 weeks to see lasting results. If warts appear...
Hey, Doc, what the hell is this?
I don't know, but it don't look right.
Please contact your local Jonestown chapter. And remember to check out Select Auto Shift for a sweet 45-degree win.
Fuck yeah. As much as I can pack into a bottle of Cognitive Interrupter Alpha. Now with advanced perineal hydrosodium extract. On sale for the next 2.5 minutes with free shipping and handling.
Introduce.
That was made by Space Kook, and I'm going to put their Patreon up. If you give them $1 a month, we get more animations like that. And I love them. Cognitive Interrupter Alpha. It only takes 141 weeks to get results. I've been using it, of course. We're just making fun of Melonhead until we get some real commercials. We do like Mushekels. I lost Robert on the line, but I have him back. I just answered a question on have they always been pussies? Short answer is yes. You can throw your 2 cents in. Because they say, well, they've won these wars in the past, right? So why are they such pussies now?
Am I here now?
Mm-hmm.
Well, like, even if you look at 1948, even in any writings you can find anywhere, in any historical documents, there was no doubt from the Israeli side, other than the duration of 2 weeks in the entire period from 1947 to 1948, that they would lose or suffer any sort of significant defeats on the battlefield. They knew that they could easily destroy the Palestinian forces in 1948. In 1948, most of the Palestinian fighting factions had already been expelled. All of their weapons had been taken away from them. They'd killed them, destroyed their houses. Then this started with the British. The British did this. And in the Civil War phase of Palestine's history, which started back, the 1920s, they started dispossessing land in great proportions. The Israelis, these Jewish settlers did. And then they had the uprising 1921, there was uprising 1923, there was an uprising. And in the 1930s, we sort of had that climax. During this time, the British took away all their weapons.
And that 1921 uprising was started by Jewish communists. Just want to point that out. Two communist groups fighting with each other. That's how it physically broke out.
And also what they did there is that they wanted to establish complete sovereignty over the Wailing Wall. At that time as well, like, historically, Jewish people had always lived in that land for the past few hundred years anyway. About 50% of the population of Jerusalem, they'd never wanted to establish sovereignty over any piece of land and say, this is ours, that this holy site is ours and blah, blah, blah. So, of course, if you come in and you're these white Jewish settlers coming in and suddenly you want to establish sovereignty over something, you better expect an uprising. And they also wanted to push that further, and there was allegations that they wanted to go and they wanted to take the Temple Mount, which that can't be proved, but the Wailing Wall was definitely something in their interests. And then later on, we had, of course, even if we're looking at the terrorist organizations, which at first were trained by the British, armed by the British, the Irgun, the Stern Gang, the Haganah, the likes of this, and they got all their weapons, all their training from the British, and then they turned on the British and started killing the British. And they killed the first UN peace negotiator who was sent in there. The Stern Gang assassinated him in 1948, and in 1949, Israel were then introduced into the United Nations for the first time, and one of the first major statements ever made to the United Nations by Israel, by their ambassador, was that they did not want peace with the Arabs, because then they would demand land, and they would demand the return of refugees. That's something they said in 1949. They've always been cowards. They always knew they were going to win the wars. They bored out governments so that there wasn't going to be any sort of major fight back against them. And the Arab armies that came were small. They were not well-trained. They were not well-coordinated. Many of them didn't like each other. They weren't unified. They didn't have good weaponry. And the Israelis just rolled over them. And even if you look at the Israeli system of government, they don't have a constitution, because the reason why they don't have their own constitution is because they took all the British law and everything that was under the British, and they copied it, and they said it was Israeli now. Oh, it's Israeli law. But they copied the legal system, which was implemented under the British mandated Palestine, and changed it into Israeli law. Like, everything. They didn't. There's nothing that they created. They didn't go and to this barren wasteland and then just create it into Shangri-La, like they tell you. Actually, they destroyed most of the land in many areas. And they plant these European trees all over the place as well, by the way, which not only destroys native plant growth in some circumstances, but also catch fire, and they have these fires all the time there. I mean, everything they've done since their inception, every single war they've fought for, there's this Israeli historian, I forget which university that he released his study from, but he wrote a book, which his name is Zev Maoz, and he wrote a book, and his conclusion, going through every single war Israel had ever fought, his conclusion of all of the wars they'd ever fought in their history were that never have Israel fought a war of necessity. Never. With the possible exception of the 1948 war. And by that, he meant that, you know, obviously they had to expel the rest of the Palestinians and fight them off in order to make this state on most of Palestine more than what was given to them in this ridiculous mandate.
But that was reacting to their own provocation of going around and beheading people and slaughtering villages and things like that. So there's really never been a war of necessity. And never, they've always had either the French or the British or both on their side. And they've always had American weaponry, et cetera, on their side. And the sides they're fighting get paid off. Like in 2006, they fought Lebanon. The Lebanese military didn't fire a single shot. It was just Hezbollah, like guerrilla groups. And Israel lost to the guerrilla groups. Tanvir asked again, should Bashar al-Assad be replaced democratically once Syria is prosperous and safe again? I think I answered that. That might have been when my mic was muted or whatever. But again, I think it's funny that they starred the name Assad because it starts with ass. And so it didn't write it in the comment or whatever, but I know what you're saying. That's up to the Syrian people. It's unlikely, since he just defeated ISIS and won a war, that he's not going to get elected again. But most likely Syria is going to federalize, and that all that territory north of the Euphrates, where the Kurds are now, is probably going to be another state. There might be three states. It'll be sort of like the United Kingdom. It'll be like three or four little states under one federal government, and Assad will definitely be president. I don't see, he already just got elected by an overwhelming majority, and I don't see him stepping down right after winning a war. Presidents don't usually lose after they win wars, especially this war. He saved Syria. So it's up to the people, though. And, you know, they can vote for who they want to vote, but I just don't see any real candidate, outdoing Assad right now. But it's all up to them. They do have a democracy.
At least.
Go ahead.
At least it was the Syrian people determining that now, and not anybody else.
Yeah, if Hillary had her way, she'd rig the election. Remember what she said about Gaza? Oh, we should have set it up to make the side we wanted to win win. That's what they did in Haiti. ISIS equals IDF. No, ISIS is not the IDF. ISIS actually fights and doesn't piss in their diapers. You know, ISIS is Al-Qaeda, which is financed by Israel and armed by a lot of people. The IDF is financed and armed by the United States. But they don't ever fight anyone where, there's a weapon bigger than a slingshot.
Well, the Israelis and ISIS have the exact same mentality. It's just changed from Judaism to Islam, except ISIS are able for what they're talking about, whereas the Israelis want to manipulate and screw people over to get where they need to get to, and they're not prepared to put anything of significance on the line. So that's the difference between the two of them. One is manipulative and controlling, the other one is a psychopath that just goes out on a anger streak. And the one that's manipulative and controlling normally prospers, and of course ISIS are a bunch of psychopaths. But you could say they're more brave, but I would say they're just insane.
I keep seeing a lot of comments about the Irish suddenly, and with people in chat talk about what they want to talk about. You know, Ireland recently, this summer, was what, in July or June? They passed a bill, and they are no longer buying products from the occupied areas. They are boycotting Israeli goods from the occupied areas. Good on Ireland. I hope Irish Americans can follow suit. My hope is, I think it would be LARPing to say the United States do the same thing, but if we could get a predominantly Irish city like Boston or something to pass a resolution, say they're boycotting Israeli goods, I would be ecstatic. And good on Ireland. I hope other European states follow suit. You know, the Irish, they've had their period of land confiscation and slavery, and they've been on the whipping post, so they understand Palestinians. They know what it's like to have your houses taken away. Or, you know, to quote-unquote own it would be taxed into oblivion and starved to death. And they know what a blockade is. They know all that because they suffered like that themselves for long periods of time. But, you know, now when it comes, the generation of Irish who study Irish history and know what their forebears had to go through, they can sympathize with Palestinians and say, yes, this is not another colonial movement out of Europe, mostly Ashkenazis, that went down and annexed territory. And so if we could get more European states, maybe an Iceland, maybe a Poland, somebody to pass similar resolutions, you know, the U.S. is going to be last because parasites put all their energy into the strongest host, which right now is the United States. They're not putting a lot of effort into capturing Ireland like they are to D.C., right? So because of that, they don't have enough power to spread around anymore. So you're starting to see pieces break away that are losing whole countries who are no longer buying Israeli goods. And there needs to be more of that. And there needs to be a focus on getting things like that accomplished instead of running around yelling at buildings and saying free, free Palestine or whatever, that kind of feel-good activism. We need legislative action. We need economic action. You need to boycott Israel. I feel about that very strongly. I put it on shirts. I put it on mugs. I say it. I wear these everywhere. I was just in Los Angeles wearing Confederate shorts, a Boycott Israel shirt, and handing out plastic straws. I mean, you want to talk about people getting triggered. But that's what we need. You need to call Congress and tell them, why are we sending another $5.5 billion to an apartheid regime that has marriage laws, you know, against races and build a giant apartheid wall and shoots little kids, has snipers shooting teenagers in the face for throwing dirt clods at them? Why be doing that?
It's insanity. I mean, looking at what they're doing now, if we look at the Gaza Strip, they've killed, the official figure is that they've killed 171 demonstrators since March 30th by way of sniper fire. The Israelis have unarmed demonstrators who showed up to protest were shot, many of them on video. There were many journalists. There were about 30 children that were amongst those shot dead, the unarmed protesters shot dead. And 18,300 plus people have been injured. And what do we see? Like, I mean, we don't even, like, I haven't even seen many demonstrations for this. There's nothing. I mean, it is a bit shameful. Like, at the very least, like, I saw you the other day ringing up in regards to Yemen to support a bill. I mean, at the very least, you can do something like this. Takes 30 seconds out of your time. Or support somebody who's working on a project. Go and support them. Get behind them. You don't want to do that. You don't want to put your name out there. You don't want to be the one on the street. Get behind people who are doing it. Like, there's, like, you know, as long as you capitulate, they think they can do more. No, if you let a criminal away with a criminal action, they're going to keep doing it. You have to punish them. There has to be some form of punishment to that criminal, or they're going to go further and further and further and further. And you have to get to a point where you stop these people, or you do something and you take action against these people. And it affects everyone, what's happening here. What they're doing and all the wars that they're dragging everybody into, it affects you all. Everybody's been affected by this. In the West, you're being affected by this as well. You don't see it. You don't think that's the reason because you're not told that's the reason. But like you outlined earlier, like people, like you are really being affected. I mean, the amount of money we're spending there and not looking at our own countries. And then everything becomes, oh, it's Mr., you know, such and such, the black person or the Muslim person, or it's the right wing or it's the left wing, or it's all, yeah, blah, 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 these people and these people, this group of people. And it's always blame, 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 blame. Nothing is ever done. And you don't look at the real people who are doing it. Who are their decision makers? And if the decision makers are not making decisions in the interest of the people, then go to them, consult them. If they don't change their ways, then you have to remove them.
Spunkmeyer like, Sr. wrote, BDS, yeah. BDS stands for Boycott, Divest, and Sanction. And yeah, hell yeah. Thanks for the 2 shekels, Spunkmeyer Sr. That always helps. Yeah, you got to support people who put their neck out on the line, you know, whether it's us or like a Philip Giraldi or an Allison Weir, who's going to be on the program Monday, by the way. You know, Philip Giraldi lost his job at the American Conservative just for saying the J word. You know, but it doesn't matter when we talk about the Russian government. We just say the Russians, and everybody knows you're talking about the Russian government, not all Russians, whatever. But when he said Jews, and you know he's talking about Zionist Jews in Israel, you know, or that was too much. But we throw around words like the Kurds, like, well, the Kurds or the black community is like, well, it's not every black person, not every Kurd. You don't need to sit there and language police people to death, but people have lost careers over the sensitivity police and SJWs on this issue that care more about, you know, the splitting hairs over language and stuff instead of the content. I mean, he had a full article explaining what he's talking about, and it didn't matter, you know. And I had Philip on right afterward. £10 actually. Is the white genocide a real thing in South Africa? Yeah, I mean, unless you've been asleep forever, and actually President Trump actually tweeted about that, and I was surprised because this has been going on. It's been going on in Rhodesia too, where farmers in Africa are being attacked and by racist blacks who it's the dumbest thing in the world. Like, well, obviously way back when there was unbelievable colonization and racism on the part of a number of European countries in the South Africa that straight up murdered people, stole land. Everyone knows that. Enslaved people, had an apartheid state. That does not mean then that later, a generation later, that you can flip the script and start murdering white people. That's just as wrong as murdering black people. But if you defend them, suddenly you're a Nazi. And again, you got to be able to stick your neck out there. And who cares if someone calls you names, calls you anti-Semitic, says you hate blacks or hate Africans or whatever? It's not hating anybody to say, hey, stop murdering, raping, and burning farmers. I don't care what color the farmers are. And the other thing is, they're not replacing them with black farmers. if you kill off the farmers and you don't replace them with some other kind of farmer, you're going to starve. And that's going to be the ultimate result. They're all going to suffer from their own idiocy. But President Trump actually like acknowledged that white farmers are being targeted in South Africa. I thought, wow, doesn't the president know that if you defend white victims of anything, that you're a Nazi? Well, they're going to call him a Nazi no matter what he does anyway, so he might as well do the right thing. But, you know, what makes it hard is, well, I want to talk about South Africa. I want to talk about any issue, Ukraine, etc., where whites are the victim. I have to deal with the stigma of all these ass clowns that are going to accuse me of racism because there actually are a bunch of dumbass racists who are motivated, you know, by that. And the only reason they give a damn about these people is because of their own racist ideology. I am not one of those people. Murdering people is wrong, period. It doesn't matter what color they are. That's common sense a three-year-old can understand. However, ultra-liberals aren't at the level of a three-year-old, so they're like, well, they deserve it because, you know, generations ago, somebody in their family might have done something wrong to someone else. Sins of the father type nonsense. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous, but the thing is, that's what's happening in Palestine, too. You've got white colonists from Europe killing brown people, which is, it doesn't matter what color is killing what color. You have a bunch of foreigners that came in, annexed territory, and murdered little kids.
Like, in this context, right, like, you have to be able to speak about it in an open way without throwing any terms at each other, right? So, to just call somebody racist for saying, look, white farmers are being killed and not look at any context is just ridiculous. At the same time, to use a word like, oh, there's a white genocide, like there's a some sort of huge movement. There's psychopathic people that are doing this. The government gets in on it because the government of South Africa are equally as psychopathic, and they sold out as well.
And often killing other black tribes, too.
And they're killing just as many black people all the time.
The black-on-black crime in Africa and South Africa especially far surpasses the black-on-white crime. Same as crime statistics in the United States or basically anywhere. Mostly in groups kill themselves.
Yeah, and like you have to look at it in its context, because if you just look at it from the point of view of it's just white people who are being targeted and there's nothing else in South Africa that's happening at all but white people being targeted on farms, then like you're not looking at the entire picture. And people, when they pick out one thing and they talk about it and then it's just focusing, oh, there's a white genocide. Well, I mean, originally you can say, oh, these people came and they colonized, but they're there. It's like the Israelis right now are there. Would I advocate going and killing them, raping their women and killing their children? No. No. As much as they've colonized, they've came in and they killed people there. I think the settlers need to leave. I think anybody that cannot live peacefully side by side with Palestinians should leave and get out. And that's my view. And I seriously think that people should share power more so. There's not like this, the situation in South Africa did not significantly change other than a few laws being passed, and it got worse for people. It got worse for the poor people of South Africa when they changed that system. Now, it's not to say that there needs to be apartheid back. That's to say that it's been controlled. These governments are always controlled, and everything that's happening there has been calculated. And they do. And also, you got groups of people who are fanatics, and they go and kill each other. And that's another thing that happens. And that's another product of the history. And to look at things, of just pull little things out of context. And I think, honestly, my opinion on Trump with all of this is that what he does is, I seriously think and I feel like he's been thrown in there to try and get people to engage back with this political system and push right against left. Because everything he says, it can be interpreted two different ways. If you look at it from just a rational point of view, most of the time, what he said, it's not racist most of the time. You can reason with a lot of things that he says, not all of it, but a lot of it. And he kind of go, yeah, he made a fair point here and there. But if you take it out of context, and it's racist, and a lot of people that follow him as well are racist, and they want to believe those things are racist and that everything he says is racist as hell, and they want to believe that. And you can't have a nuanced opinion like this. You've either got to be completely on the side of I hate him, everything about him. Now, I hate him. He's a Zionist puppet. Like, that's what I think. I think he's no different than any other president. He just has different policies in certain areas and he has different people who own him and different ideas. Some are good, some are bad. And this is like every single president before him. I think they're all a whole bunch of terrorists that don't represent the large majority of people in most of their policies. That's personally my perspective. But people take everything out of context. They can't discuss this topic without throwing around the word racist or bigot or you're this or you're that or effing liberal this or whatever. And they can't look at each other and just have a conversation. If you disagree with me, beat me down to the ground with facts. And I listen. You. And if I think you're wrong, then I can go back. And like, what's the problem with that? Why can we not have a civil discussion like that? Like, it's taken completely out. And we just have to throw these terms at each other, these big terms, and beat each other down on everything rather than discuss things in their context. And it's annoying, to be honest, because you cannot say anything now.
It makes a lot of people not want to talk about it at all because they don't want to deal with the stigma. Like, there are a lot of people who do not defend white farmers in South Africa because they don't want to be associated with all the actual white segregationists and separatists and so on. I don't think you should ever button your lip because you're afraid of being called a name, but I'm just talking real politic here. That's how people are. But, you know, this situation, like Robert said, it's been exacerbated a lot because of the UN food program and aid to Africa and a lot of these so-called humanitarian organizations that make things worse because not so much in South Africa, but in a lot of surrounding nations, the food programs are destroying people's agency. Like, imagine if you're trying to sell shoes, and I open a shop right next to you, and I just give away shoes. How many shoes are you going to sell? You're not going to sell any. I'm going to put you out of business. What happens to the agrarian society in Africa if they have to compete with UN food subsidies and, you know, all the slew of UNICEF and the rest of it coming in and giving away rice and giving away food? They can't. Well, then that just makes them sell off their land or use it for some other purpose other than growing food, which is what the food aid was bent on doing, because they wanted to grow rubber and other products that you can't eat in order to sell the raw goods to Europe to make finished goods to sell back to Africa. It's a big gambit with commodity companies like Glencore, and they're being ganged up on. I have a film about this. It's called What's Keeping Africa Down? But because of this, a lot of the neighbors flooded into South Africa from the surrounding states, which were dismantled systematically by taking out their agricultural sector and making them dependent on food aid. They become completely dependent. And if you don't build something up, you can't just quickly start growing food in a day. It takes a whole season, you know, at least just to get one round of crops. So this isn't something you can fix right away without tapering off the aid. The aid, you know, giving people food actually hurts them in the long run. It only helps during a crisis, during a drought or something. But if you create dependency in a welfare state, then no one's going to build up that industry, and they're never able to, you know, have agency themselves and sell their own products and food, and then that, you know, use that as revenue for other parts of infrastructure. So they've had the rug yanked out of them from the bottom. These people flood in, and they see that, well, in South Africa, there's these white farmers, you know, who actually own agriculture, and they're saying, they have all these farms. We don't have any farms. The reason the South Africans have farms is because they kept that free welfare aid out of there. And so they're able to actually have a turnover. And so this is ignorant, but on their part, they're seen as they own all the agriculture. We don't have any. We can't ever get anything started in our own place. We don't have the real estate once we go across the border because it's already been gobbled up. So they're physically trying to steal it from people instead of buying it from them or going to work for them or doing the civil type of thing. And so this whole problem is, it's built on policy. You have to look at UN policies, US policies, and policies from abroad that are affecting the entire agricultural sector to begin with. The farm subsidies, too. If you know about Bacon's Rebellion in Virginia, that's a lot about what's going on. Because it's not all white farmers being attacked and murdered. It's certain ones, the ones on the bottom. The people on the top, if they run the ones out of the bottom out, they have more of a monopoly over the product in distribution and in production. And so what Bacon did is he went around burning tobacco farms around Virginia, not to stick it to the man or to fight the governor. He did that so that he could sell his own tobacco at a higher price by getting rid of competitors. And they are using the anger of Native Africans to attack the middle and lower class white farmers and destroy their agriculture and run them off, because a lot of them just run away because they don't want to get raped and murdered. And then what happens to that land? Either it goes to the didn't do who do nothing with it and aren't competing anyway, or or that gets gobbled up by the Big Ag. And this is real. You can look at this and see that the Big Ag of South Africa, which is totally tied to foreigners, by the way, through Mark Rich's old company mainly, same thing with Zambia, same thing with a lot of African states, and you see that they are using this violence as a means to destroy the lower-rung competitors and gain a tighter monopoly around distribution of agriculture and production. That's what's really going on. It's hand in glove, and these useful idiots, you know, these black racists that get all riled up and go and burn a farm or whatever, they're pawns. They're getting used. They're getting used by Big Ag. And so you really need to look at that. And Big Ag isn't black, okay? But it's also their government. So there's so many problems. But again, to have this sort of nuanced view and look at the entire history and the economics, that's not what happens. People dwindle it down into race war or something, you know, retarded like that. And then commentators don't want to speak on it because it becomes a tar baby. And you don't want to touch it because if you do, you're going to get thrown into one extremist camp or the other. Because black racist is just as bad as white racist. And you just got these two polarized rams butting heads with stupidity. That's enough on South Africa, I think. Thanks for the shekels. You want a more in-depth answer, donate again, or just go watch the film. There's a film called What's Keeping Africa Down. It gets into the refugee issue. It gets into transfer pricing. It gets into the food issue. It explains a lot about what's going on. And you can really use that as a model that gets reused in the Middle East. It gets reused on Native Americans. It gets reused in Latin America. It's the same song and dance. Sorry for the rant. Robert's laughing. I go off, man. I was like, it pisses me off and be like, why are you talking about this? I talk about it all the time. I made films about this shit. You know, you know what you can and can't say on YouTube. And defending white people is something that will get you banned, unfortunately, on social media. It's like, I've been banned for my opinion on the Civil War. You know, I mean, like, they're not the privileged class. We all know who is the privileged class. And you're not allowed to defend certain groups. But I'll do it. I do it on Vimeo. Spunkmeyer Sr., another 10 shekels. Can I get your guys' takes on the Lotus Revolution cock that removed Mubarak? Yeah, but I need a breath, so I'm going to pass it over. Mubarak was paid off. That's
Unfortunately, I have to get going because I have to.
Oh, shoot. Okay. You know what?
Yeah.
No. I will make a video about that right after this because Robert has to go. But essentially, really quickly, since you sent the shekels already, you can drop off Robert if you need to go to work, man. It's all good. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm sorry I took up all the air at the end. I didn't know you had to go, though. I'm sorry.
No. Yeah, I just realized the time I was looking over at it and trying to, like, but yeah, I've got to go.
All right, man. Sorry. Peace. Take care. I hope I can get you to D.C. this year.
Definitely.
Excellent. Stay on the lines. Robert has to go to work. The question was about Mubarak. There it is. Mubarak, you know, Egypt, after this long story again, I'm going to sum it up. A series of Egyptian leaders have been paid to look the other way. And closing the border to Palestine, for example. Shutting down electricity and flow of people, goods, etc. across the southern border. And Mubarak, if you look at it, the second highest recipient of U.S. aid after Israel, with the exception of a few years in the 90s, was Egypt. During the 90s, there was a brief period of time where Turkey was the second and Egypt was third, and that was when Turkey was ethnically cleansing Kurds. But for the bulk of history, since the Suez Crisis to now, the Egyptians have been paid off to look the other way, second highest aid recipient after Israel. And mainly that was under Mubarak's tutelage. And they paid them off. They threatened them with the MB, the Muslim Brotherhood. And Egypt itself, you had a lot of people living on $2 a day, a lot of unemployed, a lot of impoverished, a lot of people, you know, seeking basic subsistence. A lot of them lived on rations or welfare from the government. We all know welfare doesn't work, especially in the long run. Just it encourages failure. I've heard that speech. And they paid him off. But Mubarak ran his usefulness. He was getting older. They had a massive revolution which started organically and then was quickly CIA'd. And that was the color-coded multiple revolutions in Egypt, which briefly had a junta that reopened the Suez Canal to Libyan and Iranian ships. And so Gaddafi made massive contracts with Asia for oil, and so somebody knifed him in the butt and killed him. And then there was another revolution in Egypt, and they finally got Sisi, who is again willing to take his shekels and look the other way, close the border to Gaza, and allow Israel to abuse the Palestinians. Egypt is the most populous Arab-speaking country. They arguably were the strongest for a period of time, although now, you know, Iraq and Syria are sitting pretty. Iraq's stronger than it's ever been before. They smashed the Peshmerga in a number of, like, 36 hours or something. But they need to control Egypt. And that's the system of government since World War II. You can no longer, besides the Israelis, nobody goes in and just defeats the country, annexes their territory, and colors it in on the map as, you know, part of their colony. And that's because the Geneva Conventions won't allow that. It didn't work too well after World War I when they stole pieces of Germany and awarded it some to France, some to Poland, and we all saw the result of that. Was a rise up and then kicked off World War II. So they don't annex territory. What they do instead is they buy off the leadership and they install puppet regimes who effectively act as managers within their own government. It ensures the flow of resources in the direction that they want. And it used to be like the United Fruit Company during the Banana Wars, the Sugar Trust, the Steel and Iron Trust. Nowadays, it's Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, all the aerospace companies, as well as the logistic companies, not just like Halliburton, KBR. Just making sure it was on. But also the Huta Marine, which is like Saudi Arabia's Halliburton. You can think of it like that. And Huta Marine's the one that wants to build this pipeline through Yemen to a place where UAE and Saudi troops are already positioned in Al-Mahra, M-A-H-R-A. And that's what's going on. I mean, you've got these giant megalithic corporate entities that are not really separated from the state because 99% of their business is state contracts. So essentially communism, it's state reallocation and distribution of wealth. And that's why we need a separation of business and state. Shameless plug. You can get this book, The Separation of Business and State. This is the second edition. The first one has a sort of green cover. But check this out, because this book will explain how the government is just involved in fuckery and everything they do. They have a reverse Midas touch. Instead of changing everything into gold, everything they touch turns to shit. And that's it was been like that since Lincoln. The mercantilists took over, and that's when you have the state awarding monopolies to plutocrats who basically bribe their way into getting state funding. That's what the Israeli state does. Through AIPAC, they just bribe Congress by financing their campaigns into awarding a bunch of other people's money, the taxpayers, over to Israel, which then keeps recycling a portion of that back into new bribes to continue the process over and over again. That's what they do with the Port Authority up in New York and New Jersey. And I made a film about that. It's called Trump's Zionist Ball and Chain. God is not a real estate agent. All of these films, the Africa film, the Trump film, my 9/11 film, they're all on Vimeo on demand. The Palestine updates, like Robert and I have like over 20 in there, and there's some good videos of Zionists knocking themselves out and wetting their pants and crying on the floor and things like that. But every time I try and put it on YouTube, they say that we're not allowed to do that, and they give me a strike. And so even when I put it on the backup channel, same thing. Reina's been banned twice already. My other backup channel's gone completely suspended for infinity. So I have to be very careful with this one. This one's the one that has 12 years worth of videos on it. And so I sort of pull punches a little bit, but not too much. But all you gotta do is go through the links. Everything's on Patreon. Everything's on Vimeo on demand. We're trying to get the information out there the best we can. But if you've noticed, especially this month, August 14th, PayPal cut funding to my Patreon. They will no longer offer their services to Patreon. You can use a credit card still, but you can't use PayPal. And that's not the first time PayPal has acted up against me. A number of great journalists got banned from Twitter. Scott Horton, Daniel McAdams, Peter Von Buren. He had everything expunged. He wasn't just banned. He was completely ovened. They took down everything he's ever done. There was a writer for 21st Century Wire, I think Robert Higginson, he got banned. And then, of course, Jonestown got banned, and he took all the attention. So that's why we have to move to Vimeo, to BitChute, to Discord. These super chats are great, but we don't know. This could be temporary. I'm pretty sure it's going to be. My Twitter, while it's still up, is called Rye Liberty. I'll just write that into the chat real fast. You can add that. I'm on Facebook. I've been on for about 3 days, but I've been banned 7 of the last 8 months, so most likely I will get banned again. I only had it for a little bit in May. I usually get to use it 2 or 3 days, and then I get oven for whatever, for anything. Last time is because I said redneck, and that got me banned. First time that ever happened. I've never been banned for bashing on gingers, though. Isn't that something? But, you know, ginger is just the N-word rearranged, as somebody likes to say. I always say it's the other way around. I think Patrick Little got banned again. No shock there. A lot of great accounts get banned. I think Jay Dreyer got banned from WordPress or something. Another journalist, Caitlin Jonestone, or Johnstone, sorry. She got banned. She got back on. All she did was make fun of McCain. I mean, I had a poll on Twitter saying, when McCain dies, what's the best party food? Brain food, Vietnamese food, roasted songbird. I forget. I had a bunch of smart-ass choices, but I didn't get banned for that. But I don't really have a big Twitter following. I usually get banned. I'm always banned on Facebook. I've been oven a couple times on YouTube. I'm banned on Instagram. I don't even know what I did. Don't care. I had my t-shirt company banned. So I can't use Teespring anymore. That's why we have Teasley. These Boycott Israel shirts are there. And it's got the cool ANC logo on the back. And I think we offer one with just Boycott Israel on it too. So get in there. Allison Weir is going to be on Monday, 4 p.m. Pacific time, California time. If you're interested in that. And we're going to walk through a timeline of Palestine and Israel. Because everyone starts in 1948. And I think it's very important, Robert sort of touched on it today, to walk through and see all the violence from the Stern Gang, from Irgun, from these terrorist groups that created the State of Israel that were killing British sailors and killing British officers, killing Palestinians, and killing fellow Jews for trying to leave Palestine. And I do have a film, part one of a longer film on that. It's called The Jewish State, in scare quotes, How Terrorists Formed a Nation. Again, they're all on Vimeo On Demand, and I swear I will put the Vimeo On Demand link in the chat, in the super chat, and it'll be in the description of this video once it's saved on YouTube. Go on Vimeo On Demand and prowse around. Maybe your issue is Palestine. Maybe it's Syria. Maybe it's the September 11th attacks. Maybe you want to learn a little bit about Africa. Maybe you want to see the video Decades of Deception, which goes over 50 years of CIA fuckery. Prowse around the titles and get what you like. And those shekels, of course, finance future films. We're currently making one on Yemen. I'm very excited because some of my friends from Discord are helping with that. And the production value on this one is going to be better than any of them that I've ever made. Because I'm just doing the research and content. And I'm going to finally be able to delegate the video side to people who ought to be doing it. Which is video people. I've got one planned for Afghanistan. And, of course, the RFK-JFK film, which is now two films. There's an RFK film, and then there's a JFK side that I'm working on. And that's the ultimate goal on Patreon. We're, I think, just under $400-something away from making that. It is so worth it. I got a whole box full of documents on JFK, notebooks and notebooks on RFK-JFK. And, of course, you've heard me on Tim Kelly's podcast talking about RFK for 2 hours. There's a 3-hour interview with Michael Collins Piper and myself about JFK. I've talked to Doug Valentine about it, Jeff Blankford about it. I've been on a lot of shows. They're all up on YouTube somewhere. They're all on Patreon, and they're all on Vimeo On Demand. All the woodsheds are on Vimeo, too. If you've seen the Taken to the Woodshed, if you want to show somebody Bernie Sanders to the woodshed, Hillary to the woodshed, whoever, you know, any kind of ass clown, Tom Cotton, Pat Condell, I think Shapiro, like all these people have been getting woodsheds. And that whole series is on Vimeo On Demand as well. So I'll take any questions. I'm about to butt out unless I get a big question here soon. I'll give the chat time to think and write something. Really appreciate the shekels. I'll give you this link. Well, that's that's a good link too, but there's the girl that got murdered. This just breaks my heart, man. This kind of stuff that they do. Let's see. We got a subscription goal. There's a nice anime when that happens too. Here is the link to donate. If you use this one, the Streamlabs, it doesn't take the 30%. Let's see. Someone writes, is Africa poor due to low IQ? I think low IQ is due to being poor. It's the other way around. It's, that is a factor, but it's pretty insignificant compared to the other geopolitical factors. There are other places with low IQ that do well and places with high IQ that don't do well. Policy matters the most. I always say as example, look at North Korea, South Korea. They both have an above average IQ compared to the entire world. South Korea is the 11th largest economy on earth. North Korea is dead last because it's communist and has a dictatorship. It doesn't matter how generally smart your population is if you have the wrong policies. It does matter how generally dumb your population is even if you have the right policies. But if you look in any African state, no matter how poor it is, it's not uniform. If you look at the port cities example in Mozambique or in Tripoli or name your country, they're all doing very well and are very wealthy. It's the inland areas that are suffering, and it doesn't really matter what the IQ is. It matters slightly, but sea access and sea trade is by far the larger mitigating factor. I mean, that's the difference between just the coastal region and the inland region of the same country. And even within the United States, places like Kansas are never going to catch up to California, regardless of its ethnic purity, IQ, or whatever, because they don't have an ocean. If you don't have an ocean or a river, just like landlocked places up north, Kazakhstan and stuff, you're just not going to do very well compared to coastal regions. So trade is the largest factor for poverty versus wealth. As far as innovation and things like that, yeah, low IQ matters. You're not going to be building a space program or inventing the new cell phone or anything like that without a large population of high IQ. But even that mainly just comes from a very small group of people, and you just need a bunch of worker bees. You don't need that many queens. Free markets lead to success. And you can take a country like Singapore that went from shit poor to a booming city state, and it's a multicultural, it's pretty high IQ now, but it didn't start that way. That's why I say it's the other way around. Like, as your state starts to fall apart, smart people leave, you know? And it goes the other way. When you're really successful, a lot of do-nothings will come try and parasite off you. And that's happening to European states right now. The people that are coming from Northern Africa and Pakistan and stuff up to Europe are not the doctors and surgeons. It's not the smart part of the population. It's the ones that are going there for free welfare. So when you're really successful, you get drugged down because you'll have the impoverished and the left side of the bell curve come flood your area. And when you're really poor, a lot of the brain drain happens. So as the very intelligent people in India and things are leaving and getting jobs in New York or wherever, so, you know, both things happen simultaneously, but what happens is you get a larger stratification over time where the poor get poorer and the wealthy get wealthier, unless that wealthy have an open borders welfare state. Then they start going the opposite direction too. The way to fix it is to have more inroads. If you have more railroads and pipelines and canals, etc., so that the transportation of goods and sea trade especially can reach inland areas, then they prosper too. And so that's mainly what Africa needs. Africa, you don't understand, is way larger than it looks like on a map. On a map, the northern territory, like Russia and all, looks, Greenland looks bigger than Australia. It's huge. In reality, that's not how the world really looks. You can squish all that down and you make Africa a lot bigger. A lot of inland Africa is more than 50 miles from the nearest river. And if you take the same kind of case up north or in Latin America, in North America, Europe, wherever, where there's an area that's 50 miles from the nearest river, it's dirt ass poor too. But, you know, along the coastline, you have very wealthy cities, and inland you don't. And that's just the nature of geography. It doesn't matter who lives there. And, of course, the people who do live there and remain there and would stay in such a spot are going to have a low IQ. Because why the fuck would you stay in a place like that, right? So they're going to migrate out, and did. And the same thing in any other area. So any other questions? Anything. It doesn't have to be about Palestine. You can ask about Africa. You can ask about whatever. I mean, that's kind of a quick answer. I'd like to show you the proof of that, but just start looking up coastal cities in Africa on Google Images, and you can't really tell the difference between that and a Houston or a Singapore or Tokyo. Like, they're very built up, they're international, but that is the nature of having access to water versus not. And that's why they're fighting over Yemen. It's real estate. The whole eastern half, you know, is wrapped, Saudi Arabia is wrapped around. They got Bahrain, Qatar, the UAE, Oman, and Yemen hugging the coastline, preventing them from having direct access to Asia. All they have is their southern belly in the Red Sea, and that has to go through a bunch of different territorial waters, Sudan, or North Sudan, Djibouti, Eritrea, and then Somalia, and of course, Aden. And they're fighting over the port of Aden. We are still fighting over the Maritime Silk Road. And it's important to understand the economic incentives here that are sort of hidden under the, oh, Sunni, Shiite, religious fighting. That's what's going on the puppet level. On the puppeteer level, it's all about controlling sea access, ports, pipelines, and the import-export of mainly oil and natural gas. Duh. But we never seem to dig down to that layer. It's always orientalized and just saying, oh, the Houthi or Shia. And that matters in the sense that, why hasn't Saudi Arabia just expanded their kingdom in there? Well, because they're Sunni, they have a monarchy, and Shia are not going to live under a Sunni monarchy, so they're not going to sell off their land to them or anything, so all that's left is to take it through force, which they've been trying to do since the 60s. And Europe has a vested interest in keeping a balancing act where nobody gets clear control, they're constantly caught fighting each other, which keeps them stagnant and prevents them from being an economic rival to European hegemony. So that is the geopolitics of Saudi Arabia and Yemen in like 2 minutes. I see a lot of other questions. I'm going to give it a minute. You throw a shekel, I'll answer it. Otherwise, I got things to do. Don't be mad about the shekels. I rub my hands like this. Okay, then. Please consider calling your senators about Yemen to support the Murphy bill. I'm going to end on this. It's not a bill. It's an amendment to a bill. The NDAA is going to be amended to freeze funds to Saudi Arabia over their inhumane treatment of Yemen. So Chris Murphy otherwise is a total dirtbag. And you don't want to support the Murphy Amendment banning guns. But the Murphy Amendment to the NDAA freezing funds to Saudi Arabia, that's what you want to support. So call your Congress critter. It's 202-224 and then some extension. There's 50 of them. But call your Congress critter and urge them to support the Murphy Amendment freezing funds of Saudi Arabia over the Yemen war. Please do this and encourage others. In fact, if you can, if you want to, take your phone, your cell phone, or your web camera and film yourself doing the call. If you send that to me, we'll make a compilation. I really think it's monkey see, monkey do. And when people see how easy it is and they're not intimidated, more people are actually going to take that action. So call your Congress critters. I guess it's 9 at night in the United States, but tomorrow morning, call them up and voice your opinion. Tell them to stop the war on Yemen and support the Murphy Amendment. Thanks so much. Peace.